Why have I asked my electrician I found on Angie.com to bury my pet hamster Nibbles in our yard for me? Because I was so moved by how carefully he buried my electrical wires, I knew I could trust him to bury my sweet Nibbles after his untimely end.
Huh, Nibbles. Gone too soon. May he scurry in peace.
Hey, sorry about your pet, but I just wire stuff.
Nibbles would have loved you like a brother.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicles, where I'm joined once again by Stelios.
Hello,
and
everyone.
We're going to be continuing our discussion of the voyage, the grand adventure of Jason and his Argonauts. So there is simply so much to say that we won't spend too much time just reviewing what's happened so far. But just to say that Jason has been sent out on this grand voyage by his half-uncle, really, Pelias, who is king of Iolcos and who seized the throne against Jason's father, Aeson. And Pelias has sent Jason out to go and retrieve the Golden Fleece at the far edges of the known world in Colchis, which is on the eastern edge of the Black Sea. And this is supposed to be an impossible task. It's supposed to be something that Jason is not going to survive and come back from.
A suicide mission.
An absolute suicide mission. However, because the idea of going to retrieve the Golden Fleece was such a tantalizing prospect for glory and renown and heroic deeds, of course, it brought with it, when news spread that this was going to be undertaken, some of the greatest heroes from across Hellas at this time. We've got Polydeuces, we've got Pelias, father of Achilles, we've got Telamon, father of Ajax, we've got Idas, we've got so many characters. And so far, they have weathered a lot of their problems because they have had with them the mightiest hero of all, Heracles. And just at the end of book one, as we were recounting at the end of the last part, the crew very absent-mindedly leave Heracles behind on the shore when they're going up the Pontos.
Which is preposterous. How can you forget Heracles?
Yeah, the guy who's like 7 foot tall and bulking. You're like, oh, I just didn't notice he hadn't boarded the ship. But it is explained to Jason and the other Argonauts before Jason has a mutiny on his hands as the Argonauts force him to go back for Heracles. That actually, this is all part of divine will.
Yes.
That this was never, it was never Heracles' fate to continue with the Argonauts to Colchis. He already has his own destiny, which is to fulfill and complete his 12 labors.
He just needed a sea taxi.
Yes.
And he helped along the way.
Yes.
He wasn't just a passive passenger.
Right. And so.
And one thing to mention there is that this was in a sense divine intervention.
Yes.
And the sea god Thavmas, I think.
Glaucus.
Glaucus,
from
yes.
Nereus, I think.
Yes. He appeared to them and said, don't worry, it's not his fate.
Mm.
He has his labors to continue.
Mm.
And you need to get on with your journey.
Right.
It's divine will.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not something that wasn't supposed to be. So.
Mm. And that calms the men down again. And they press on. Although I will say that... I suppose now is the most appropriate moment to just say this particular thing, which is that throughout the rest of the story, though Heracles is absent from the tale, there is constant reminders from Apollonius that the men did, even if it was divine will, the men kind of did leave their ace behind, right? The most powerful man, the most, you know, incredible weapon that they had in their arsenal is no longer with them.
The hero, they wanted to lead them.
Yes.
But he said, no, it's Jason's quest. Mm. He has the prime say.
Yeah. And so now they really are stuck with Jason as leader. Yeah. Having said that, Jason is going to come into his own more and more, as we'll see when the journey goes on. So let's continue it.
But can I say something here? Because that's more symbolic than people realize. Mm. Because Jason is a very distinct type of leader.
Mm.
And Heracles is a different type of hero, as well as leader. So they wanted him to lead, but he understood that his kind of leadership wasn't the pertinent one for that quest. And this can mark the transition between the agonistic spirit and the spirit of Odysseus. Or in other words, it's the same transition from the spirit of Achilles to the spirit of Odysseus in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Mm.
And people, especially when Apollonius was writing, lived in a different time than they understood their past to be.
Mm.
So essentially he said, we can't live in the age of heroes anymore. In the sense of the atomized sense, nothing to do with modern conservatism. I mean, it isn't just one hero meets the other hero and they have a clean fight, a fair fight.
And the strongest is the most moral because he punches the hardest.
It's not Achilles versus Hector anymore.
It's not might makes right.
Yeah, it's not Achilles versus Hector anymore. Mm. It's now we're at a time where civilization has been a bit more complex and more complex solutions have been adopted. And people do echo this in their thinking.
Yes. And we're actually about to see an example of that play out now, because at the start of book two, we're immediately launched into the Argonauts stumbling upon a place called Bithynia. And there just so happens to be a particularly terrible king called Amycus, who is the king of the Bebrekians, which are something of a savage tribe. They're just very aggressive, right? They have a very aggressive foreign policy against the surrounding neighbours. And I wanted to read the first part from this because it really pays to listen to how Apollonius himself frames and presents Amycus to us. So he says, "There were the cattle stalls and pens of Amycus, proud king of the Bebrekians, whom a nymph, Bithynian Mele, had borne to Poseidon Genothlios, with whom she had lain. He was the most outrageous of men, and even upon strangers he had imposed a shameless ordinance. No one might depart before trying his luck against the king in boxing. And many men from neighbouring territories had thus met their end. On this occasion, too, when he came down to the ship, he arrogantly scorned to inquire of their mission and their identity, but at once addressed them as follows. Listen, you sea wanderers, to things which it is proper for you to know. It is a law that no stranger who has come to the land of the Bebrekians may depart until he has lifted up his hands in combat against mine. Therefore choose the best man from among you all, and set him to box against me here and now. If you choose to ignore and trample upon my laws, you will find that the consequences will be grim and violent." So he spoke in his haughtiness. Wild anger seized the Argonauts when they heard, and the threat struck Polydeuces most of all. At once he stood as his comrade's champion and replied, "Enough. Do not practice your wretched brutishness upon us, whomever you claim to be. We shall fall in with your laws, as you have stated them. I myself now willingly undertake to fight you." And so I like immediately the fact that, again, it's not just Jason and the Argonauts. So Jason does everything and the Argonauts just kind of like, you know, sit around as his hype men. Like, it's a truly collaborative effort. Yes. Argonaut gets a moment to shine. They get their heroic deed, something that propels them that bit further along the step than they would have gone otherwise.
Yeah, it's essentially the sea of the state of the of that age. Mm. Plato uses this analogy, I think, in the Republic. He mentions the sea of the state, the ship of the state.
Yes.
And I think when it comes to this, it reminds me of the agonistic spirit. And it's the spirit of a fair competition. Mm. One, for instance, that you see in the Olympic Games.
Right.
There's the spirit of, you know, clean and fair competition, where, you know, steroids aren't good. And Amicus isn't staying out of harm's way. Mm. In a sense, he doesn't say, I'm ruling because I have to. It's like he thinks he has to earn it. Mm. And he constantly puts that status to the test. That's why he's fighting there.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing to remember, because there's another shift that happened there. Or it's an implication of the shift I mentioned before, from the spirit of Achilles to the spirit of Odysseus. It's that now we may say human beings always lament about the past, and they always think that the past was better. It's just human constant.
Yeah.
It absolutely
happens
is.
In every age.
It happens in every age, and my hunch is to believe that 99% it's a personal subjective issue, that people would love to be younger. They don't growing up. So this has always been the case. And the narrative of perpetual decline and social disintegration has always been with us. Mm. And what is funny is that we may look back to the ancient times and say, yeah, the ancients were great and we are the bad ones. But even then, they were looking back into the past and they were saying, no, the golden age
is behind us. The true time was the age of Homer.
Now we're in the Iron Age.
Yeah.
So it's another way of saying, well, these old ones, they had that agonistic spirit, which is much more noble than us. And we are locked in a sad state where it's not that the best man always wins. It's much more of a collaborative effort. Mm. And there is tremendous collateral damage along the way. Because if you look at that kind of warfare, it's not like in the movie Troy, the beginning.
Right.
You have two champions. Achilles slays the other guy.
Yes.
And that army instantly goes with the Greeks, who were championed by Achilles. Things went way more destructive later.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And we see here in the
and it's sorry for me to add this. It's that there is a kind of tragedy there, in that you can compete fairly without winning.
Mm. And we see in Amicus as well the fact that it is egregious to the gods that this fight is even taking place, because actually it betrays hospitality, right? It betrays the principle of Xenia. Yeah. And so Amicus is putting himself forward and actually twisting the just order of the gods in order to basically appease his own ego, so that everyone who comes along, they know that he is the strongest and most renowned, and, you know, that he is basically just the top barbarian.
Yeah, there's another side to it, yeah.
Well, what's the other side to it?
No, the one you're mentioning, because I painted the sort of good portrait of him, but yeah, you have a point also.
Yeah. So he is violating guest right. But also, as well as that, the actual imagery that Apollonius employs is very, very black and white. Amicus is portrayed as like this kind of like chthonic figure, this unenlightened figure, whereas Polydeuces, or Pollux, I think, as a Romanized version of his name is. He is described, one of the particular descriptions I love is just how soft, like, the first scratchings of his beard are and everything. Like, he's young, like, he's not actually had anywhere near as much experience as his opponent. But Polydeuces is fighting for the divine order. The imagery that's used to describe him is very, very heavenly, it's very lofty. It's showing that he is fighting for a purer sense of justice. And we also see this reflected as well in the actual fight when it breaks out. It's funny as well, because he the way that Apple, or this particular translation of it, decides to use the word thongs to describe like the leather straps that are put around, but the idea of like two men just like hitting each other with women's underwear with just some thongs is the first thing that went into my head when I wore it, and unfortunately I couldn't shake it out. But there's this quite brutal boxing match, right? It's described as the fact that they are just going at one another, and that eventually Paulo Diakes is trying to maneuver around him, is trying to, like, he's analyzing his opponent, he's analyzing Amicus and his fight strategy. And then it mentions the fact that he employs that same strategy on Term with both its strengths and its weaknesses. And we see Paulo Diakes adapting to the opponent in front of him until they're both so exhausted that they have to both go and have like a timeout, you know, get the water over their heads and everything. And then when they metaphorically step back into the ring, it's the last fight that Amicus is ever going to fight, because Paulo Diakes accidentally strikes him around there.
He Jake Pauled him.
Yeah, and it kills him. And it just just falls to his knees in immense pain, and then just falls to the floor dead. And
nasty round way
one,
to go.
Yeah, a nasty way to go. Round one for the Argonauts, I suppose. But this, again, represents the fact that they have gone there. This is something that they're only... He's only dead because of his own laws.
Yes.
Right. He's only dead because of his own laws.
And it isn't just his own, just the fact that they are his own laws. It's the fact that they violate the divine laws.
Right.
And there is hubris.
Mm.
That is the cardinal sin in the Greek mindset of the time, the mythological frame. You mentioned the key word, xenia, and it's hospitality. And even now we're a very, very hospitable nation. You know this.
I do.
And I'm very proud about this. And in a way, we need to remember that Zeus wants people to be hospitable to strangers.
Mm.
It's a two-sided street.
Mm-hmm.
It's a two-sided thing. It's not unilateral, it's bilateral. The host needs to be a good guest, needs to be a good host, and the guest needs to respect the host. In the Odyssey, for instance, we have both violations. We have Polyphemus, who violates hospitality when it comes to Odysseus and his crew in his cavern. And we then have the suitors who are violating hospitality, who are violating the opposite law. They disrespect, they abuse
the
Odysseus, Penelope's, and Telemachus's hospitality.
Mm.
And both get their comeuppance. And here, the same thing happens with Amicus. He FA'd and he FO'd.
Yes. And also as well, once we see, I mean, to speak of the fact as well that Amicus is really foreshadowing an even more uncompromising figure later on in the story, in the case of King Aeetes, who's over in Colchis, as the big bad of the story, for want of a better way to put it. But as soon as Pollux accidentally manslaughters Amicus and he falls to the ground, all of Amicus's men immediately start wanting vengeance for the king and start fighting. And Jason and a few of the other Argonauts immediately get their weapons out and obviously start coming to the defense of their own man as well. And the difference in skill is described in such a way where Apollonius says it was like a wolf amongst the sheep, or it was like gas being put amongst the bees, you know, because the Argonauts are just so much more impressive than the men around him. And I think there's something symbolic in that as well, which is that it speaks to the fact that the Brebrekians are just unable to stand against the Argonauts, because each of the Argonauts is a very accomplished warrior and in a way are their own hero. Whereas in the case of the Brebrekians, these are just thralls, they're actually nobodies. Because Amicus just consolidated all of the power, all of the glory, all of the ability to prove himself in himself at every opportunity. And so everyone else is just quite green.
he in a way disarmed them.
Yeah.
One thing we have to ask here, and I'm not drawing any conclusion, it's a question I'm posing myself now because I can't answer it by now, is to what extent the Bebrycians had divine blood? Because you'd say that the battle is a bit unfair because the many of the Argonauts have divine lineage.
Yeah.
So in a way, I don't know if that's that much of a...
Yeah.
Of an achievement.
Well, then
maybe we don't know. Maybe Amicus had divine blood or something.
Well, perhaps a lesson in that then is just not to go around fighting everyone who comes to your door because they just might happen to be a demigod.
Yeah, don't go ape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they also pillage.
Stop chimping out.
Yeah, they take a bunch of goats and you know, things for sacrifices later, and they
Glad you qualified it.
Yeah, they loot and plunder the Bebrycian lands, and then they get back on the Argo and behave. And then we get to a really remarkable and quite a large part of the story, which is they end up meeting Phineas. And this is quite an extensive part, and it's obviously quite a famous part as well. Now, Phineas is the son of Agenor. And Agenor, for those who don't know, was also the father of Cadmus as well. And so when Europa was kidnapped by Zeus, many of Agenor's sons went out into the Mediterranean to go and look for Europa. And of course, Cadmus founds the city of Thebes at the behest of Athena. And we saw about how all of that comes to ruin when we covered the Barcae by Euripides, and we see what happens to the house of Cadmus. But though this is taking place after those events, Phineas is still alive because he has been cursed by Zeus, because he is a prophet, like Cassandra. He is a seer and he's able to read the futures and the fortunes of others. But Zeus has cursed him because Phineas was foolish and clumsy and revealed the entirety of someone's destiny to them and left no room for misinterpretation. And so for revealing too much of the mind of Zeus, Zeus cursed Phineas to be blind, to be aging, to age beyond his time and to be perpetually old, which is why he's still alive. But it's a case of like, yeah, he's alive far longer than he should be, but he is suffering. Like, it is horrible to witness this poor man.
It's absolutely horrible. And the punishment is really... tough, harsh. We are going to talk about this, but I want to mention something here, which is very interesting, because what happened with Phineas was that he got, in a sense, access to the divine mind. And he revealed the entirety of the situation to some people. And that was the crime. He shouldn't have done so. He was granted the privilege and he sort of abused it because the gods wanted him to give only very selective and partial and fragmentary information.
To nudge people in the right direction.
Exactly.
As has been happening to Jason.
Exactly.
Throughout the journey.
Exactly. Because individuals are also tried. There is a sort of contradiction in almost every story when it comes to gods and human agents before the concept of free will was developed. Because you simultaneously think that gods are responsible for everything, but also that human beings are responsible for their actions. And that's a huge tension, which is it's almost everywhere present in Greek mythology and other mythologies. I don't know if other, but it's definitely there in Greek mythology. And one of the interesting things also about the oracle is that when it comes to the delivery of oracle, of, you know, what the seer said, the verdict of the seer, it always had to be ambiguous. That was the thing, because people had to start interpreting it instead of taking it as a face value. It wasn't just, that's it, that's the word of the god, and it's given, and you are just given the word of the God, and you aren't going to think about it.
Yes.
It was, you had to think about it.
Mm.
Because part of it had to do with self-knowledge. And it's not a coincidence that one of the engravings on the Oracle of Delphi was "Know thyself."
Mm.
That's one of the commandments of Apollo to human beings, essentially. And they have to do their own work. They have to do their own homework.
Mm.
It's not that it's going to be completely given to them.
Yeah. And also, as well, the fact that Phineas did, he reveals the entirety of Zeus's plan for this particular person or that particular person, that loosens the sort of dependency that the mortals have on the gods, because you don't have to constantly sacrifice to them and pray to them and devote yourselves to them, because you have already been told exactly what is fated to happen to you. And so we see this constantly in the way that though there have been numerous examples already in the story of where people like Nereus and Glaucus have come to the aid of the Argonauts, for example. So they have witnessed divine intervention in their own story. But that doesn't actually stop them throughout the entire tale giving sacrifices to Apollo, erecting shrines throughout the journey as they go on. They're constantly putting themselves in deference, under deference to the gods. But obviously, as I say, with Phineas, it's a case of revealing too much and therefore basically freeing humanity from the oversight of the gods, which is, of course, not acceptable, and is one of the other reasons why Prometheus was punished for giving humanity more than the gods wanted them to have. And so Zeus punishes him by this in not only making him perpetually old, not only in making him blind, but also in making him starve as well. And it's really brutal. And Apollonius describes it in such grim but vivid detail of the fact that, you know, like there is like nothing beneath the skin but bone. He is really, really struggling. And throughout all of this as well, there are local people who are constantly going to him for their fortunes and want to have a reading for their future. But at the same time, they are offering Phineas food as a thank you for getting a reading for their future. And this food is constantly taken from him by the harpies, who are vicious creatures and are really just enjoying watching Phineas suffer. And not only do, when he's going to take the food, do they swoop down and take it from his hands, so he's constantly tempted by the food but can never eat it. When he does finally, with what food that is left as well, they leave the stench on it that is so foul, so repugnant, that he can't even contemplate eating it. And so he's constantly punished first and foremost with starvation. However, there is...
He's like a gooner with a safety search tag on. Yeah, that's it, because he is...
What a parallel.
Because he has the desire, and he's just there. He wants to eat, which is human,
Yeah.
And food is just around
him. It's all around him, but you just can't access any of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
However, there is a silver lining, because Phineas also knows from prophecy that is not his own that Jason and the Argonauts are going to come along to his island, and eventually this curse will be lifted from him. That, you know, there is a future that is not just more of this.
Yes.
And so even though he's blind, as soon as Jason and the Argonauts arrive on the shoreline, Phineas is immediately ready to meet them. He's looking forward to the first good meal in a while.
Yeah.
And he goes through this lengthy monologue about basically everything that we've recounted now, about what his curse is, why he was cursed, and how he's constantly tortured by the harpies. And also, as well, that in this prophecy, it was said that the sons of Boreas would have a key part to play in this. So just as in The Last Island with the Bebrycians, we'd had Pollux and his moment to shine, now we get the Boreads, we get Zetes and
Calais
as well. And they are to chase the Harpies away whilst Phineas is able to tuck into a Toby Carvery.
To indulge.
To indulge himself. And so the Argonauts set up this wonderful plan to basically lay a banquet ready for Phineas. And then when they use this as bait to draw the Harpies down, the Boreads, who are, let's not forget, able to fly because they have wings in the side of their ankles. And I think before I might have incorrectly said that they have like wings out the sides of their head as well. I've seen numerous like portrayals of them and they're all a little different, but they can fly. They fly now.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The world's biggest soccer tournament has arrived, and you can trade the entire tournament on Kalshi. Spain is currently trading at over 17% to win it all, meaning a $100 trade pays out over $530 if they win soccer's biggest prize. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code JUMP to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see Kalshi.com/regulatory.